Tonight is the second Dharma talk in a series of eight over an eight-month period to deal with the Noble Eightfold Path. Last month, we looked at the assumptions that we have, the attitudes, values, and other states of mind, sometimes called views. And together they constitute our worldview. And in going through the exercises that I included in handouts and emails to people taking the full course, we looked at different aspects of these views or states of mind. And in doing this, many of us saw what the Buddha meant in this first passage of the Dhammapada. We are what we think. All that we are arises from our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with an impure mind, and trouble will follow you as the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unshakable. So it's both a curse and a promise to have these set views in our mind. And the trick is to have a wise understanding instead of one that's false or based on principles that will cause us and others harm. The link between our minds and what they generate and our negative feelings, our suffering, or dukkha, is very direct. And it's pretty easy to see once we learn how to look for it. And if you've been around for a few years, and a lot of you have, you probably have spent a good deal of time looking inward. And so that's a lot of what is involved here. It's just getting to know the geography of the mind. But then there's something else. There's more to it really than that. We need to really look and see if the views that we have lead to happiness or unhappiness. And as we did these exercises, some of us could even see the views that underlie the obvious views, the ones that we had already spotted. So in the Dharma talk last month about wise understanding, I defined what the Buddha said composes wise understanding, and it is the law of causation, or karma, and the Four Noble Truths. So basically, it's about suffering. It's about the fact that we do suffer. We're not always happy. And there's a cause for this suffering, which is that we're clinging to something. And it's a perfectly normal human tendency which causes all of this perfectly normal suffering. But the good news is that there's an end to it. It can be ended. And the way to do that is the rest of the Eightfold Path. And I got some feedback during the month that in doing these exercises with the wise understanding, there was this yearning to fix things. You know, oh, I can see that. And how do I change that? Well, there are seven more parts to the Eightfold Path, and we need them all. And in the normal course of our Sunday evenings, we teachers are trying to kind of put them through a blender and make them easy to access. But the Buddha laid them out in eight separate steps, and that's the way this course is intended to approach it. But also from a practice point of view, so that we are really working with our experience. There's some reading materials. There's the book by Bhikkhu Bodhi on the Noble Eightfold Path. And then there's these Dharma talks. But the core of it is using what we learn from the, you know, words to look at our own experience and understand what in our own lives was the Buddha talking about. So when we apply wise understanding to the stuff, the views, etc., that are in our mind, we can recognize which of those are wise or unwise. Suffering, not suffering. This recognition is very similar to what the Buddha did on the night of his enlightenment. Mara, who personifies all delusions and unwise impulses, tormented the Buddha with horrifying visions and seductive pleasures. The Buddha sat tight during Mara's show and said simply, "I see you, Mara. I see that you're false. By understanding which ways of seeing things lead to suffering, we move into a similar position to end their power over us." Just the way the Buddha broke Mara's power. So, moving ahead on this Eightfold Path, we can go forward, onward, with our new wise understanding about dukkha and its causes, and begin to confront our way of being in this world, starting with our intentions. Views influence our intentions. The way we look at things determines how we want to act about them. If we understand that an attitude or value that we have leads to unhappiness, that will determine how we intend to act as a result of that view. But if we misjudge it, thinking that this view is good for us, when it actually makes us and others unhappy, our resulting intentions and behavior will be unwise. But maybe the worst consequence of these compounded mistakes is the effect that it has on our character. Our thoughts come and go, but the effects of our harmful intentional behavior stay with us. They determine who we become on a moment-to-moment basis. Is that scary enough? I often think of that as karma. It's our rebirth every moment into this evolving person that is us. Our intentions also have an impact on the world. When we look at the major problems confronting the human world now, what we see are the results of society's rampant consumerism, conflicts, oppression, and willful ignorance. We're all guilty of that. It's so easy to see people with opposing opinions and say they are not truthful, or they're willing to say something knowing it's not true. But if we confine the information that we take in to what already resonates with our bias, there's some willful ignorance in that too. What's wrong with the world comes from our collective greed, hatred, and delusion, which is just a fancier word for ignorance. So intention is key to the quality of human life, whether it becomes rife with suffering or kind and peaceful. The exercise that I suggested you do over the last few days in looking at your intentions, if you did it, it probably revealed very quickly that our intentional conduct plays out in a swirl of various and sometimes apparently conflicting motivations. I vividly remember the first time that I tried this practice of watching intention. It was on a retreat. I could barely get out of the meditation hall. The possibilities were few and simple. I could just go right upstairs for walking meditation, or I could first use the restroom and get a drink of water. But as soon as I looked at this simple choice, the complexities overwhelmed me. I just stood stock still, interfering with traffic. It was raining, so I'd have to put on my shoes and my jacket to go out to the restrooms. At least I had to put on my shoes, or my socks would get wet. And, you know, another pair was way over in the residence hall. So I had an advanced case of yogi mind because I'd been nonstop practicing for weeks. And it was not easy for me to organize all of the intentions that were involved here, even in this simple choice. So, in the rush of our daily lives, isolating your intention while, for example, you're grocery shopping can be very difficult. It's a big mixture of motives that we're always juggling. For example, food shopping can involve intentions to spend wisely, to have a healthy diet, to delight friends coming over for dinner, to take pleasure and find comfort in our food, and to direct money toward causes we support, like organic farming. and all of this all at once. And in addition to being mixed, our intentions are usually layered, with the deeper ones giving rise to the ones that are easiest for us to see. As we practice cultivating our awareness of our intentions, we come to see deeper and then deeper ones until at some point we catch a glimpse of our really core intentions. I once asked someone in here, what was her heart's deepest desire? And I could see that my meaning completely escaped her. The suttas say that all sentient beings have the basic desire to be happy. This core intention often gets lost, though, as its little offshoots grow nearer to the surface of our awareness. And as a result, some of us can think that the way to get happy is to go north, and others are going south, and others are going east and west, and they all think they're going toward the same thing. Wise understanding simplifies our task of telling whether it's wise to hold and act on a particular intention. We just have to ask, will it lead to suffering for us or others? And as we keep paying attention to the intentions prompting us to act and applying this litmus test to them, we become ever more skillful in our way of engaging in the world and more in tune with the deepest yearning that we share with all other beings, no matter what direction they think they're going in. We all want to be happy, to be peaceful, at ease, and spontaneously loving. And in the meantime, we have lots of help from the rest of the Eightfold Path. Intention, as I've indicated, just naturally moves into conduct. So from here we go into the parts of the Eightfold Path on wise speech, action, and livelihood. And they will give us readily accessible guidelines for our conduct, which will lead us to act in ways that cause the greatest happiness for all, until such time as the intention is so deeply grounded in us that we make these choices automatically. The core intentions of Buddhism are letting go, goodwill or metta, and compassion. And I know you've never heard me talk about any of this before. Letting go, metta, and compassion. Now, reading the suttas about these core intentions can be confusing because in Pali, words for them have the same root in their negative and their positive forms. So, for example, in Pali, it's kama for craving and nekama for non-craving. But in English, where does non-craving leave us? We feel like we're just, you know, at a precipice, and there's no next step there. The English words we associate more commonly with these good intentions are letting go and renunciation. And by the way, I recently gave a Dharma talk by exactly that name, letting go or renunciation. And this is the first of three intentions the Buddha said make up wise intention. It is the opposite of unfettered desire, greed, lust, or craving. This part of wise intention is to let go of what we're so fiercely wanting, that sometimes we'll do anything to get it. Now, letting go is usually a process, but if we start with the intention, if we renounce the craving, we have begun the process. The opposite of the Pali words that mean wishing ill and intending harm are goodwill and compassion. Or to simplify both, kindness. And to simplify even further, let me just say that I have a picture of the Dalai Lama by the door as I leave my bedroom with the caption, "My religion is simple. My religion is kindness." It's there to remind me, what is my core intention as I step forward to start my day? Another image that comes to mind for me is of birds arranging their feathers so their wings will be in good shape to take them flying. They're not vain. They're not going after bugs most of the time. They're just making sure their feathers are connected. And that's what I'm doing with my intentions. By glancing at that picture and lining them up with this key intention to be kind. And this is how we can best take care of ourselves and those around us. By remembering it's all about protecting all beings from suffering. The intention to be kind, to have loving kindness and compassion for all, protects us from acting out of our desires that don't serve us well, that can harm us and others, and that leave us even more prone to intentional and unwise conduct in the future. Now, we can practice letting go. And a good way to do that is more of this exploring that we did last month with views. It's to feel the burn from these burning desires. And this is a really good time to make it clear that renunciation is not about denial or repression of our desires. It's kind of the opposite. It's a natural dropping of a state of mind that happens when we understand that clinging to a desire is like clutching a coal that sort of covered with ash, you know? So we don't feel it right away until we've held it for a long time or we're clutching it tightly. That's how they used to borrow fire from the house next door. You know, they would take a tin receptacle and, you know, put ashy coals in there, and it could be carried over to your house, and, you know, it wouldn't burn you unless you held on to it for too long or you held on to it tightly. And our desires do that. Our clinging to our desires does the same thing. So the practice is to watch it. Feel the burn. So the practice is to experience that we're clinging to something that's actually burning us until our whole being, all of what we are, just drops it. Instead of hiding our desires, we let ourselves directly feel the dukkha of wanting something so powerfully until we don't want it anymore. Now, as you can imagine, some people shy away from this exercise, but I guarantee you it is far less unpleasant than the consequences of letting those desires rule our lives and possibly harm us and others in our compulsion to get what we want. So I've talked a little about letting go of unwise intentions, but there are also ways to cultivate wise intentions in addition to trying to drop the unwise ones. With craving, for example, we cultivate generosity because it changes our focus from what we don't have to what we do have. And rather than feeling that we're lacking, we see that we have enough to be able to share with others. And in the practice of dana, we actually do let go when we give. Now, to cultivate loving kindness and compassion, there are phrases you are probably somewhat familiar with that we can repeat to ourselves during meditation to either generate those feelings of kindness or at least to incline the mind toward them. Also, when ill will arises, either in meditation or during the day, we can remember to counter that ill will with goodwill. Instead of telling ourselves the story over and over about how someone has harmed us, we can summon up feelings or thoughts of metta and compassion. Now, we may not be able to do that when we're still in the heat of anger at someone who we think has harmed us. Maybe we can't feel that way or even think that way about that person. But we can probably think of someone that we can feel goodwill toward. Or compassion. Someone we know is suffering. So we can bring up these kind feelings just to bring in goodwill and switch off that aversion or bad will. If that won't work in the heat of a negative passion, maybe we can remember to practice restraint, holding our tongues or not hitting the send button on that email, and by taking no violent action. That separates us from increasing our tendency to yield to aversion. So, if you can't have kind intentions, at least contemplate them. There is great power in setting an intention, whether it's before settling into meditation or entering a meeting room or leaving your bedroom. We can always tend our feathers so we're safe to fly. Thank you.